Chapter 6.3 is about molecular dynamics. Molecular dynamics is a very widely used tool in atomistic simulations. So you essentially solve numerically Newton's equation of motion, which means that in a molecular dynamic simulation, you have the full information about all the atoms in your system. That means you know at any point in time where are the atoms and with what kind of velocity are they moving. So actually, to have both information about the positions and the velocities, of course, you have to assume that the particles are classical particles, but the nuclei, with the exception perhaps of hydrogen or another few very light atoms, the nuclei are fairly heavy and they can very well be approximated as classical particles. So if you now propagate Newton's equation of motion numerically, you get something like in a film, you get different frames. You have a time step, which is kind of the time interval between two frames. And so you see kind of actually not in a completely continuous way how the system is moving, but if the time step is small enough, and of course it looks like if you look then at the movie, it looks like a continuous movement. So with molecular dynamics, you can do many things. I mean, first of all, you can calculate thermodynamic averages. That means you can calculate certain properties that then typically depend on temperature. Like, for instance, if you are interested to see how a solid is expanding with increasing temperature, for instance, you could see that very easily in a molecular dynamic simulation, simply by kind of looking at kind of the average distance between atoms, which then would become larger when the temperature is raised. For such calculations, and actually we will later on we'll discuss several quantities that can be calculated at thermodynamic averages. So for such calculations, actually there's still a second alternative method available that we will discuss later on. Also, those are the so-called Monte Carlo method. So for thermodynamic averages, you have typically always two possibilities. However, the next two applications that I have listed here on page 103, they are kind of now specific to molecular dynamics. So for instance, you can calculate non-equilibrium thermodynamic properties such as transport coefficients. So if you have a system that's not too far away, then I mean many transport phenomena are kind of relatively small perturbation, and it turns out that if you study an equilibrium system, you can also extract information about how the system would behave if you are slightly out of equilibrium. Finally, of course, MD can be used to follow any atomistic process, such for instance as a chemical reaction or the opening of a crack in a material. Yeah, that's obvious because also what is happening in nature, I mean, if you could really watch the atoms move, right, you would exactly kind of get the same kind of movie that you would get from an MD simulation. And then, of course, you can see, yes, a chemical reaction. Or that's now an example here on the next page, 104. You could, for instance, study how a crack is propagating in a really big chunk of material. I mean, in those big simulations, MD simulations, people can use millions of atoms. And now if you understand, for instance, this process, how a crack is propagating, that can be very useful for engineering applications. I mean, those cracks are typically studied in metals or actually alloys. And yes, if you make an airplane wing, for instance, out of such an alloy, of course, you don't want cracks to form because, of course, then the stability of the wing could suffer. And you would like, for instance, to understand what kind of impurities in an alloy can slow down the propagation of such a crack. And yeah, such an understanding, for instance, you can gain by just watching the movie that you have obtained from a molecular dynamics simulation. Yes, of course, if we propagate Newton's equations of motions, of course, we know we need the forces. And as we have seen already before in different contexts, there are always two possibilities. I mean, if you want to calculate very high quality forces, then you should calculate them quantum mechanically, but it's more expensive. Whereas if you are more interested in speed and perhaps not so do not need so high accuracy, then the force fields that we have discussed are probably the best tool to use. The problem is that in molecular dynamics, actually, you typically need a very large number of time steps. That means you have to calculate your forces many, many times. And so that can then become extremely expensive, especially if you do the calculation quantum mechanically. One reason why you have to use so many MD steps is the following. I mean, for many systems, you have, for instance, a wide range of phononic vibrations that have sometimes relatively high and in other cases kind of low vibration frequencies. And for instance, those frequencies perhaps can differ by a factor of 100. And now, I mean, in most cases, you're interested kind of to follow in your MD simulation kind of the slow movements, right? So the low frequencies. But now the point is that the time step is, as we will see, is related to the highest frequencies. And as a rule of thumb, you need perhaps at least something like of the order of 10 MD steps to resolve a fast oscillation. But then, of course, if the slow oscillation is 100 times slower, then you would already you would need at least 1,000 time steps. Let's next in chapter 6.4 talk about boundary conditions. That's a very essential thing in any kind of simulation. Essentially, before you start the simulation, you have to decide kind of what boundary conditions are useful. In general, I mean, at least let's say in applications in solid state physics, material science, you are interested in kind of the behavior of kind of macroscopically large systems. Of course, they are much too large to be calculated in an atomistic simulation, right? Because a cubic centimeter contains about 10 to the power 23 atoms. So we have to take necessarily for our simulation systems that are many, many orders of magnitude smaller. So let's say you would like perhaps to study, let's say, a chemical reaction perhaps going on in a liquid. Then, of course, in the laboratory, I mean, that would probably occur in some kind of glass bottle or something like that. And so you might think that also in a numerical simulation, for instance, you could introduce boundary conditions that represent kind of the walls that you would have kind of probably in under most experimental conditions. But it turns out that's a problem now if you have a very small system. I mean, if you have a very large system, right, then the ratio between the volume and the surface is very, very large. If you have a relatively small system, then this ratio is not small anymore. That means the atoms that kind of fill the surface, the number of those atoms is big, and those atoms will kind of have a strong then influence on the result of the simulation. And that's problematic. Of course, you could introduce kind of some boundary conditions where you say, well, if a particle is hitting this wall, it will be reflected. But this interaction with the wall is, of course, is completely different to the interaction that this particle would have in a really macroscopically large environment where it would always just collide with other particles, essentially, or more or less always, and never kind of with a wall because of this ratio, right, between volume and surface. So for that reason, actually, it turns out that so-called boundary conditions are best in the sense that you can approach kind of this so-called thermodynamic limit, right? This limit where the system is becoming very, very large most rapidly if you use so-called periodic boundary conditions. So that's illustrated in this figure on page 107. And so the real simulation box that I'm interested in is now this red box in the center. And you see I have there just a quite small number of particles. And you see now, if I would have kind of as boundary conditions kind of walls, then several atoms would, quite a few atoms would have interactions with the wall. Like, for instance, this particle number 1 and number 3, they would be kind of reflected by the wall. Yeah, now with periodic boundary conditions, kind of you replicate your original system. So those are then the 8 surrounding black boxes that kind of represent now. Now we have the system itself plus what's called now periodic images. So I've drawn just 8 of them. Of course, in reality, for a truly extended periodic system, I mean, you have an infinite number of periodic images. But you see already with this small number of periodic images, you see now that, for instance, this particle 3 in my red box, it does not interact now anymore with periodic boundary conditions with the wall. The wall just essentially doesn't exist. It's just, you know, that the simulation box ends there, but that doesn't mean there's something like a wall. And it will then interact with particle number 1, right? And this interaction, of course, is probably more representative, certainly more representative to the interaction an atom would have in a real bulk material than if you have some interaction with a wall. So indeed, it turns out now with this kind of periodic boundary conditions, already with a number of atoms that's not extremely large, you can fairly well approximate this kind of thermodynamic limit that you are interested in most applications. So that means again, I mean, of course, if you have a really periodic solid, a crystalline structure, then anyway, of course, periodic boundary conditions would be the natural thing to use. But even if you don't have a crystalline system, right, like if you have a liquid or a disordered system, then also in this case, it's very advantageous to use those periodic boundary conditions. So now, of course, we said that in molecular dynamics, all the atoms are moving, right? They are describing this those trajectories. And now on page 108, kind of you see again this red central simulation cell and then just one now neighboring periodic image. And what's happening here now, kind of from one time step to the next, this atom number 4 is leaving the original simulation cell, right? It can do that because this red line does not represent some kind of wall or repulsion, or it has nothing to do with a potential. And so you could first think that, well, now the number of particles is reduced by 1, and that of course would be bad, but that's actually not the case, because if this particle 4 is moving out of my central box, then this other particle 4, which is in the periodic image, it will now move exactly on the other side, right? It will move into my red box, such that again I have the total number of atoms is a constant, it's conserved. So that's an important effect, right? With periodic boundary conditions, particles can leave the cell at some point, but then from a periodic image, exactly at the same time, another particle is entering, such yes, that the total number of atoms is conserved. Yeah, now on page 109, we come to the probably most important part now, and that's really how to generate those trajectories numerically. As I said already, the underlying basic equation is just Newton's equation of motion, right? So this equation number 96. And yeah, now we have kind of to discretize it. And our kind of discretization or propagation scheme should have kind of two properties which are related, which are related to kind of the accuracy in the short term and the accuracy in the long term. What do I mean by short term? I mean, we could generate just a very short trajectory that consists perhaps of 1 or 2 propagation steps, and then we could come up. Probably we have seen that already right here. We have to discretize in equation 96. We have to discretize a second derivative. And we have seen that we can do that with finite differences. And actually know that if we would take very high order finite differences, right, then we would get a very high accuracy in such a short-term propagation. But actually what is more important in the context of molecular dynamics is this long-term accuracy, because as I told you already, you have to do typically a very, very large number of MD steps. And so it's important that kind of you generate a trajectory that's stable. And there, the most important aspect is that the energy should be conserved. I mean, you know, of course, in the exact analytic Newton equation, the energy is a conserved quantity. And so it should also be in a numerical calculation, but actually it turns out that depending on you how you discretize your Newton equation of motion, this actually perhaps it can be violated. So the energy cannot be a conserved quantity anymore. You can have, for instance, what's called a drift, which would mean that the energy, for instance, is raising or decreasing continuously during your MD simulation. And of course, that's very bad. I mean, if the energy is going up then too much, then kind of that means the system will essentially get hotter and hotter and it will kind of start to boil or explode, or I mean, many undesired things could happen then. Yeah, now it turns out that this kind of energy drift is not possible if you have a discretization scheme that is time reversible. So time reversible means that you can propagate just forward in time your system up to a certain point, that on that point you reverse your velocity, so that means you just multiply with minus one, and then you start kind of propagating, and that means in this case you propagate back. And if you do that with the exact Newton equation of motion, then you will come back exactly to your original point where you started your trajectory. So that means it's time reversible. If a scheme is time reversible, then you can show immediately by contradiction that energy drift is not possible. I mean, let's assume the energy would go up constantly while you are propagating the MD trajectory. Then, of course, if you now invert the time, if you propagate back, right, then of course the energy would also go up, but that's a contradiction, because if the energy goes up, we cannot go back the same trajectory that we came. Yeah, so that means now if we have a scheme that's time reversible, then of course it's not yet guaranteed that the energy is strictly a conserved quantity, but it's certainly the energy cannot show such a drift. So that means in this case the energy essentially can oscillate a little bit around the exact conserved the quantity which would be exactly conserved in an analytical solution. Yeah, another important property is still that any volume in phase space should be conserved. I don't go into detail here, but that's actually also an important property. And then of course, since you are using those schemes in numerical work, they should be insensitive to rounding. Yeah, so now on page 111, I kind of show you now the so-called Verlet algorithm, which has turned out to be a more or less optimal way to generate trajectories based on Newton's equation of motion. So there are several variants of this so-called Verlet algorithm. The first one is this equation 97, and probably you can see that this equation 97 is just nothing but the lowest order finite difference formula for our exact analytical Newton equation, which is number 96. Right? If you go back in our course where we have talked about calculating derivatives, you will find there immediately the formula for the lowest order second derivative, and that's exactly then identical to equation 97. So yeah, that's a low order finite difference, so that means actually the short term accuracy is not very good. So if we have a time step that I call now here h, then actually the accuracy is only something like h squared, so not a very high power of h. Nevertheless, it is, as I said, the most widely used method to generate trajectories, and the reason for that is that it is time reversible. And you also can see that if you replace in equation 97 h by minus h, and then again rearrange the different terms, then you will end up exactly with the same equation 97. And so that means it's time reversible, and then as we have seen, okay, there's no drift, we will have this kind of long-term stability, the energy will always just oscillate around the exact conserved quantity. So this equation 97, which is called the Verle algorithm, is already, that's a good discretization. But it turns out that, I will not show that, I will present you as a result. It turns out that in finite precision arithmetic, there is a second variant, which is mathematically absolutely equivalent to this equation 97, which is a so-called velocity Verle algorithm. So that's equation 98 and 99. And so you see here, you have now a new a quantity, which I call V. And well, of course, from a physical point of view, you see that essentially that has the meaning of a velocity. And so in this velocity Verle, now you have two steps. In one step, you, in this equation 98, you update your positions using both the velocities and the forces. And then in the next step of equation 99, you update your velocities. So I said that's physically, that those, this quantity looks to you like a velocity, but from a mathematical point of view, actually it's just some kind of intermediate dummy variable that you have to introduce to come up with a propagation scheme that is absolutely identical to equation 97 in exact arithmetic. But right, as I told you, in floating point arithmetic, equation 98 and 99 typically behave a little bit better than this equation 97. Yeah, let's still discuss in a little bit more detail this problem of the energy drift. And just to show you what's happening if you have a scheme that's not time reversible, I have here in equation 100, I have written down also a propagation scheme that is kind of physically motivated, that seems reasonable, and actually it's typically called Euler's method. Okay, but you see there, if you replace h by minus h, you get different formulas. And then if you use this scheme to generate a trajectory, then you see what's happening in the figure here at the bottom of page 112. So here actually I just looked at a very simple harmonic oscillator. So the exact function, of course, would be a sine and or cosine functions. And you see now that as you propagate your system, actually the amplitude of this sine and cosine function, they are increasing. They are increasing not so rapidly in the case where you have a small step size h, so those are the red curves. Kind of the amplitude is increasing faster in for the green curve where you have a large time step. But in both cases, actually, you see that's also, that's kind of plotted here, that both this red and green line kind of, they show some exponential increase. So that means really at some point your system will explode. And of course, that's something you don't want. Okay, to contrast it again, let's do kind of the same plot now for the velocity Verle algorithm. Actually here, that's now the plot on page 113. I don't plot there's a trajectory there, actually I plot just the error. And also, I mean, it's very different. Now the scales, right? You see the deviation from the exact conserved quantity is very small. It just goes up to something like 10 to the power minus 5. And so you see that you have now really oscillations, but those oscillations are not increasing in amplitude. So that means, yes, the energy, there's no energy drift. And yeah, the energy actually is conserved with fairly high accuracy of something like 10 to the minus 5. Still one final remark to the MD trajectories. I mean, even if we don't have now a kind of a drift, a single physical trajectory actually does not have really physical meaning. There is actually also in the exact, in the analytical Newton's equation of motion, there's this so-called Lyapunov instability, which means that if you change your initial conditions only by an extremely small amount, then the two trajectories will start to deviate exponentially after a while. So they will go in completely different regions of a phase space. And so that means, of course, that a single trajectory kind of doesn't have a meaning, right? It's so sensitive to the initial conditions that, yes, it's not in a certain sense unique.